Sick Boy Podcast is a health and comedy show about what it's like to be sick. Wait, is that right? How can illness be funny?
You'd be surprised.
Okay. Sick Boy is hosted by
me, Brian Stever.
And me, Taylor McGilvery.
And myself, Jeremy Saunders.
Come on in and join us to melt your heart, learn something fascinating, and bust a belly laugh. Trust us, you'll be glad you did.
You can find Sick Boy on the CBC Listen app or wherever you get your pods.
This is a CBC podcast.
Welcome to your very first showdown.
Yay! The kids are competing in their districts, each team rocking a different color and led by a town council leader. It's school field day, but on steroids. It's great TV. Kids are running around like the chickens they killed and ate, trying to fill these three large bottles with colored water, matching their team colors by carrying huge wooden-framed oil derricks to the correct spout in the ground. You can hear the excitement in the host Jonathan Carson's voice.
Blue team starting to pump. Red team has some water.
Yeah, come on.
The showdown has the sort of high production values you'd expect to see on Survivor, but it also seems like it's way too hard for the kids. These oil rigs are about three times taller than the oldest kids, and they're heavy.
Pioneers, 30 minutes left.
Go, 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 go.
Blue has two bottles. Blue very close to winning. Red very close to winning.
After some furious pumping, the teams had to run back with their pumps to the starting line to complete the challenge. The kids, they're struggling. And behind the scenes, things get even more chaotic. One pioneer, Sophia, was drenched in freezing cold water for several hours because the film crew was busy shooting and trying to reshoot the scene. By the end, she says her lips were blue.
They put me in the shower first, and I think they gave me one of those, like, emergency blankets, like the foil things, and sent me straight to one of the psychologists because I was freezing and I was so upset.
The winning team would get to choose something that could benefit the whole town. But it was always a choice between something they wanted, like pizzas or an arcade, or something they actually needed.
The reward is going to be a choice.
Ooh.
So which reward will you choose? Seven more outhouses or this? A TV that you can watch whenever you want.
Nope, you heard right. For this first reward, the kids are given a choice between getting a television or seven more outhouses. Up until this point, 40 kids were sharing just one wooden porta potty. After some deliberation, the kids choose the extra outhouses, thank God. In another showdown, the kids are made to choose between a selection of holy books or a nine-hole miniature golf course. In another, they need to decide whether they want a barbecue or toothbrushes, which begs the question, y'all are saying these kids didn't have toothbrushes before?
I came back with six cavities. Can you imagine not brushing your teeth for 6 weeks? It's disgusting.
In those situations, did you find yourself more wanting like that sensible prize or like the more fun instant gratification one?
Always sensible.
It turns out showdown competitions weren't just important for winning prizes. The producers were about to introduce a whole new dimension of competition to the show. The winners and losers were to be sorted into four social classes.
First district to fill those bottles becomes the upper class.
The winners become upper class. They have no job. They spend their days hanging out, sinking root beers in the town saloon. They still get paid $1 a day to do nothing at all.
Second place for the merchants.
Second place creates a merchant class. They get to run the candy shop and the dry goods store and receive 50 cents a day to do their work.
Third place for the cooks.
The third place team becomes the town cooks, preparing all the meals and cleaning the dishes for 25 cents a day.
Fourth place are the laborers.
Finally, at the bottom of the bonanza food chain, there's the laborers. They do the painstaking manual work, like hauling buckets of water and cleaning the outhouses. For this, they're paid a measly 10 cents per day. In the show's local currency, buffalo nickels. This sounds like a recipe for exploitation, conflict, and most of all, drama. After all, class war is never pretty. I'm Josh Gwynn. I'm an audio creative, and a lot of the work I do focuses on the impact of pop culture. Not just as entertainment, but as a lens that allows us to ask questions about ourselves and the world we live in. From CBC, this is Split Screen, Kid Nation, Episode 3, Class War. Growing up outside of LA, I was lucky and privileged enough to not really want for much. I was a kid of the 90s and the 2000s, so I had my Pokemon cards. I had my PlayStation. I had a tape deck that also had a CD player, so I could record songs off the radio into two formats. New sneakers? I had them. A place to put my head at night? Not something I was ever really worried about. It wasn't until I was graduating from college that I was actually forced to sit down and think about class, about social capital.
I think this is the most significant financial crisis in the post-war period.
There are fears the sell-off will continue on Wall Street.
Soaring gas prices, falling home prices, and rising unemployment.
Now, in retrospect, I can see how naive I was. And it's kind of embarrassing, from where I sit now, to feel as though I was a slow study on how the world works. It took time for each fundamental truth that I had been taught to be questioned by circumstance. I had always been told to bet on your education, as high as you can go, as far as you can go, and you'll be fine. Within the time frame that I had decided to take out loans and invest in my future through a top-tier, shiny education, counselors in the job office went from telling me that education was the greatest equalizer to telling me that even with a degree from a top 20 university, jobs were hard to come by. It felt like going to bed playing chess and waking up to realize the game's actually Monopoly and you just landed on all of the hotels. Around the time when I, myself, finally, really, truly started to think about the way that class impacts my life, the kids in Bonanza City, who were given the opportunity to create their own society, free from any of the baggage of our own, were also starting to experience just how hard it is to imagine ourselves outside of the structure of class.
I'm a laborer now. This morning I got up at 6. I scrubbed toilets, I did laundry, and I hauled a big barrel of water. And I just got 10 cents and I can't afford a game of jacks.
How did your Kid Nation journey start?
You know, Kid Nation, they were looking for kids from all walks of life. You know, it's reality shows, so they, you know, they have kind of stereotypes that they, you know, they play off of each other. And I definitely was in the nerd sweep. You know, so they're looking for kids who go and take college courses over their summer vacation, which is what I was very much doing. When I went to college, people would talk about all these high school parties they went to. And I remember saying, oh, we didn't have parties at my high school. And then I thought about it and I was like, of course we did. I was just never invited to parties at my high school. Like, it was so, I was so confident. I was like, that's so weird. We didn't do that at my high school. And then I was like, no, you dope. You just weren't the one people were trying to get drunk with.
Once she's in Bonanza, Sophia quickly establishes herself as one of the more responsible kids, taking on the role of the town cook, at least for the first few days. She does her best to salvage the mac and cheese on that first chaotic night, and she guts the dead chickens to prepare the noodle soup.
I'm a control freak, always was, always will be. Also very food-oriented, you know, because I'm Jewish. So I think that was one of the things I was like, all right, this has to get done, and it has to get done now.
What did it feel like, though, to be a laborer?
I think I was pissed off. I thought it was stupid. I obviously felt a great sense of worth, and I didn't want to be cleaning toilets, you know, even though I just lost this showdown. The very next day, I think I tried to stage a coup, like take a vote and overthrow the whole system. I remember getting everyone's attention and saying, like, we don't have to put up with this. We can do whatever we want, blah, blah, blah. And then a producer pulled me aside and said, you can't do that.
Sophia's failed revolt never made it onto the show, so she was forced to go back to scrubbing outhouses. But it didn't stop her dreaming of better things. One time, Sophia visits the town store and sees a rusty old bicycle hanging on the wall. There's just one catch. It costs a whole $3. And on her meager wage, It would take a month to save up that much.
I was mad that I couldn't buy something I wanted at the store. It didn't seem fair to me. I've always had a kind of an instinct of like what would be funny or like what would make put on a good show. So I'm sure that's how I got the idea of dancing.
So Sophia drops a bucket in the town square and starts shimmying for nickels. And it works. Sophia's dancing attracted a crowd. Some of the pioneers love her moves and drop their hard-earned coins into her collection jar. Others drop her some coins so that she stops. But either way, seems like Sophia's winning. Sophia's finally able to buy the bike of her dreams. The other pioneers turn out to applaud Sophia as she cycles off into the sunset. Plus one for hustle culture, I guess.
I think I was surprised at how generous the other kids were with their money, because I would have been very protective of mine. And especially I think it was Greg who like gave me like a ton of money. And I was like, damn, this really works.
Now, this whole bit of the show was meant to be funny and lighthearted, but the spectacle of a 14-year-old girl shimmying for nickels raised some eyebrows at the time. In an article for Entertainment Weekly, a writer wondered about Sophia's dancing, asking, quote, "How soon till she escalates from nickels to dollars and graduates from the street to the pole?" This type of reductive thinking was so prevalent in the 90s and the 2000s. I mean, one of Chris Rock's most famous jokes, the one about how like a father's entire job is to make sure that his daughter doesn't end up on the pole, that's from 2004. The difference in tone isn't lost on Sophia now.
I will say, I think that and many things in the show were just kind of like tone deaf, you know, as the way they'd be perceived in society. Things that, again, flew in 2007, that if you did that in 2023, you would get so much flack. Be like, she's a privileged white girl who's, you know, of course she's going to get the money. Like, yeah, I think it was tone deaf. Although one thing I will say is that Kid Nation, they mailed me the bicycle after the show was over, which was really nice of them. And then I think my dad sold it while I was at college, which is really shitty. So someone's got the Kid Nation Schwinn somewhere.
Do you remember when y'all finally won and you became upper class?
That was exciting just because we had such an incredible losing streak. The smartest, most capable kids, and yet together we are incompetent. I think everybody was excited for us at that point.
By the time the second showdown rolls around, the pioneers want to win. They want to climb the class ladder, not tear it down.
Well, it's time for the next showdown, where you guys can change your place in society, your job, and your salary.
I do not want to lose this upper class position because you get the big pay.
I think that the Yellow District deserves to be laborers because they need to get to work. They're as lazy as a sack of potatoes.
When you're a kid, you want to be the best or you want to win. It was just like you wanted money. You know, that was it. You wanted money and you didn't want to have to do the shitty jobs. But you always wanted to win. You always wanted to be upper class.
These showdowns offered the kids a version of the American dream. The chance, every few days, to improve their station and reshuffle the social deck. You gotta remember that this was 2007, the year right before the Great Recession, when the world's economy collapsed, when there was cheap credit and economic growth, imagine that, and almost an unassailable confidence in the righteousness of American capitalism. Greed is good. But also the intoxicating power of a daydream, of aspiration. When I think of this time, there's one image that sticks out in my mind. You'd see it everywhere. It was like a uniform worn by people of a certain status. White, young, pretty, vapid enough to not be threatening, rich enough to at least look like they didn't have to work. The image I'm thinking about is the Juicy Couture velour tracksuit. It was a tracksuit made of a fabric meant to look like velvet. opulent, but not necessarily what I would call durable. It looks dainty. It looks pretty. And for me, this entire era of pop culture is summed up by a matching velour two-piece set with Juicy written across the butt. The Juicy Couture tracksuit era. Before the economy came crashing down with the Great Recession, Americans were happy to daydream. To imagine what their lives would be like when they achieved success. A life of leisure. A life of velour. Tabloid newspapers were filled with aspirational images of celebrities in their Juicy Couture. Madonna, Jennifer Lopez in the I'm Real video, Kim Kardashian sprawled across her baby pink Range Rover. You can see this sort of daydreaming happening in reality television too. Shows full of velour like Laguna Beach and The Hills and The Real Housewives, all celebrating the power, exclusivity, and mobility of the upper class. And viewers greedily ate it up. But you can't see what's in front of you if you're daydreaming. The banks gambling with people's mortgages, colleges colluding to keep financial aid low and tuitions high. Class aspiration was so widespread at the time, is it any wonder it appeared in Kid Nation? At the same time, dividing kids by class is a deliberate creative choice, and so is the decision to present blue-collar jobs, like cleaning outhouses or hauling water, as some sort of horrible burden that nobody really wants to be a part of.
They build it as kids creating their own society, but what they did is they took actual society and made us participate in what existed already. You know, you have social classes and kind of like unfair competition.
Maybe Kid Nation's promise of a meritocracy was a mirage, which might be the most velourian American thing ever.
The way you got upper class is by being good at one specific thing that you had no control over, like whether it was strength or whether it was intelligence or, you know, whatever, you know, like losing a challenge and being the lower class, I think is like analogous in the real world to just being born in a station, whether it's, you know, whether it's your socioeconomic status, whether it's your color, whether it's just like you're forced to do one thing regardless of your personal abilities.
If nothing else, I guess the Kid Nation class system taught the pioneers about the value of money, which is handy because they were about to find out that there was a lot more at stake than some Buffalo nickels.
Hey, I'm Candace Lim.
And I'm Rachel Hampton. We're the hosts of ICYMI, Slate's podcast about internet culture.
And we want to help you make sense of the need-to-know internet stories of the week.
Consider us your internet historians of past, present, and future.
Of the good, the bad, and the truly unhinged.
From nuanced takes on stories we're all closely following to the ones you wished you heard about.
In case you missed it, that's ICYMI, the podcast that's extremely online, so you don't have to be. Follow and listen now.
Well, the person we felt who worked the hardest this entire time that they've been here is Sophia.
Can you remember what it was like when you first won that first gold star? Did that feel important to you?
I was shocked. I was so surprised. When they gave me the gold star, I thought it was just like a recognition. I was like, oh, that's really nice. And then when he told me it had monetary value, I was genuinely stunned. I mean, it really was a total surprise.
At the end of each episode of Kid Nation, a meeting is called and the assembled pioneers learn that one pioneer would be awarded a gold star. Not only did the pioneer receive applause, recognition, and a shiny medal, the gold star was worth $20,000. Plus, the winner got to make a phone call home to their parents.
What did it feel like when you got to call them? What did y'all talk about?
It wasn't a very long phone call, but I don't know what we talked about. I was just hearing my mom's voice because we're just all kids. We just miss our parents.
Until Sophia won that first gold star, the rest of the pioneers had no idea they were competing for the kind of cash that kids could barely comprehend. You can see the shock and the excitement ripple across the room.
And there was a sense that it was like a game changer. There's something in this for us. I was totally caught off guard. Oh, because what I got the gold star for was just, you know, being my bossy, controlling self that I was at 14 years old.
As Michael, the hippie-coated kid with the long hair, as he said in his big speech, up to this point, the pioneers were trying to show the adults that kids can actually work together, cooperatively, without greed. But once Jonathan Karsh gives the town council the power to reward one of the kids with $20,000 every episode, this collective goal vanishes.
Because it's like you think no one's watching you, and suddenly you feel like someone's watching you.
Suddenly, it's every kid for themselves.
I hope Sophia really inspired you guys, because any one of you can win the gold star, and every time it's worth $20,000. All right, back to your job.
The camera pans to Greg, the 15-year-old from Nevada who earned himself a reputation as the show's token troublemaker. You can practically see Greg's eyes light up with determination as he promises to work harder so he can win one too. We see a whole new Greg. He's no longer picking on others. He helps the town by slaughtering chickens, and he's using his pipe fitting skills. He even starts looking out for some of the younger kids. It soon looks like Greg's hard work is paying off. He could actually be in contention for a gold star. But some of the town council leaders start to grumble. He's clearly just in it for the cash. And when the gold star is awarded to Michael with the long hair, instead, Greg is pissed.
I was the obvious choice.
Campbell, my little bro, how are you doing?
I did the chickens and I did a hell of a lot more work than Michael did. I thought it was pretty disrespectful. I'm gonna do something.
And it has an effect on him. After he's passed over, Greg reverts to being Bonanza's token troublemaker, cursing at kids, getting angry. But Greg isn't the only pioneer to be motivated by the money. Take Pharaoh, for example. He's a 12-year-old from Philadelphia. There's a segment in the show where Pharaoh passionately lobbies for the gold star, aiming to boost his family's income.
I hope this town succeeds, and I hope I get the gold star. The gold star will make a difference in my life, because my mom is a single mom, and the bills aren't piling up from around her, and she's stressed out. My mom's struggling, and my family's struggling. To be honest, I think that I need the money more than all the other kids in Bonanza. I just want to see a smile on my mom's face. Yeah, I know what you mean. I just need that gold star.
We'll come back to Pharaoh's bid for the gold star later in the series. There's also Divine, an 11-year-old Red District member. While she was in the upper class with no chore duties, Divine earns herself a few extra buffalo nickels by setting up a snack stall, selling food from the kitchen that kids could otherwise get for free. And when it comes to the gold star, she goes full throttle on lobbying for herself, even resorting to bribery. She makes posters asking people to nominate her and passes out food to people in line to talk to the town council about who should get the gold star. When she's asked by the council who should win the star, Devad says me and votes for herself. Devad is girl bossing too close to the sun for me. Not everyone thought it was an endearing strategy, but Sophia is a little bit more sympathetic.
People were kind of like made to feel ashamed for wanting the money, like Devad, who was really working for it. And now I view that very differently than I did at the time. Of course she was working for it. You know, that was probably an amount of money that she hadn't seen before. And it's available to be gotten. And of course you should. Who doesn't want $20,000? You know, besides the money, the gold star represented recognition, and people just wanted to be told they were doing a good job and they were an important part of the society. And that was the only real opportunity for that in the show. So there were so many kids who I think felt empty. You know, kind of sad. You know, you got people who just like tried and it just never came. And so it's easy to watch the show and be like, oh, this, you know, this person's a loser, or this person like just wants the money, but we just wanted to feel important.
In her book, A Paradise Built in Hell, the essayist Rebecca Solnit argues that Survivor, the American reality show, wouldn't be such a hit if producers had simply dropped a bunch of people on an island and asked them to survive. The goal, Solnit writes, was to produce a single winner rather than a surviving society, a competitive pyramid rather than a party of cooperation. Under capitalism, society is often organized around the idea that there's not enough to go around, and that means there's always going to be winners and losers. And when you think about it, this scarcity mindset is central to reality TV. In fact, it's so ingrained that as viewers, we almost think conflict and competition over resources is inevitable. Like, this is just what happens when humans are put in challenging situations. In the first episode of Kin Nation, Jonathan Karsh tells the town council that the gold star should be awarded to pioneers who worked the hardest or distinguished themselves in other ways.
It's a trophy for the top kid in town. And because Bonanza City was based on mining, this 2-pound star is worth its weight in gold. Literally, $20,000.
No.
One winner is announced each episode, so roughly a quarter of the kids will end up getting their hands on one. Laurel, leader of the Green District, who we met in previous episodes, said that she had her own idea about who was deserving of the gold star.
One of our first... That would affect my decision between hearing, you know, oh, I live in a big mansion in Utah, my dad's a doctor, and my mom's a stay-at-home mom who gets Botox for fun, versus, you know, I live in Philadelphia in a walk-up apartment with a single mom who works two jobs. It did feel like a big responsibility because even at 12, I was aware of, even though I didn't get that there were social classes as much within Bonanza City, I understood social classes within the real world.
Gold Star winner Sophia was rewarded for taking charge of the cooking and looking out for the younger kids. But she thinks she was fortunate because producers, they just kind of warmed to her.
It was always very forced narratives who got the star. You know, I was lucky in terms of people's perception of me. I got this like nonchalant, I worked hard just because that's who I am. And, you know, I got this amount of money and I, you know, but would I have been working for it too? Because I was more aware, you know, like the meta. I knew this was a show, and that was ended up being a major advantage to me because they had a lot of footage of me, and you know it was very easy to create a storyline. I was frequently like a go to, get Sophia's opinion, and I think kids who are naturally shy, or younger, or didn't have the confidence, they suffered for that. So it ends up being a total microcosm for society. You know, there are real things at stake, and you have almost no control over what you're able to achieve. You know, to a certain extent. A lot of people on the show just had natural disadvantages that they had to cope with, and either they managed to, you know, pander to the producers or play by our rules or not. And if not, they didn't get money, they weren't filmed, you know. That's that.
Gold stars weren't all about greed or good behavior, though. They also offered a chance for redemption. In the fifth episode, Greg finally does win a gold star. It's not totally clear how or why the town council changed their minds and decided that Greg deserved to win, but the speech he gives when accepting the reward strikes an emotional chord.
You guys have no clue what this means to me. This right here means I'm going to college. I have no money put away for college right now. You guys have no clue how much this is gonna do for my life.
When Greg calls his mother to tell her the good news, one of the first things he says is, "This is for my college fund," to which she says, "Amen." In that touching moment, despite everything he's done up to this point, you kind of can't help but sympathize with Greg. For a kid from rural Nevada, there might be more at stake in this reality contest. These kids, they're showing up to this show with their own relationships to money, their own baggage. The question of trying to win a gold star versus being rewarded for acting altruistically is itself an example of the subtle impact of class. Who knows whether Greg's behavior truly changed or whether he was just putting on an act to win the money? In the end, he got the $20,000, which he says he put towards his college fund. I think that that's the difference between the American dream and the American reality. We want to think it's a meritocracy. We want to believe that if we're good people, if we do the right thing, it'll be rewarded. But like when I graduated, there are moments when those rose-colored glasses come off and we see life and the rules, spoken and unspoken, for what they are. We're finally able to tell the difference between velvet and velour. Next episode, the producers introduce religion and politics. What could possibly go wrong?
I didn't realize how divisive religion was in America until about that point in my life when I see everyone yelling about the simple fact of having to spend 2 hours sitting and listening to another person's teachings. But I never realized that until years later. I'm like, oh, this is a panic attack. This is an anxiety attack.
Split Screen Kid Nation was hosted by me, Josh Gwynn. It was written by myself and Aaron Keller, who was the series producer. For Vespucci, the managing producer is Thomas Curry. The story editor is Matt Willis. The series was sound designed and edited by Alice Boyd. Executive producers are Johnny Galvin and Daniel Turkin. For CBC, the senior producers are Kate Evans and Willow Smith. Anna Achete is our coordinating producer. The executive producers are Chris Oak and Cecil Fernandez. Tanya Springer is the senior manager of CBC Podcasts, and Arif Nourani is the director. Episodes are recorded at Arcade 160 Studios in Atlanta, Georgia. Our sound engineer is Jimmy Guthrie. Split Screen is a Vespucci production for CBC.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.